Good people give ear, since times are so hard. For my song to the poor, it doth pay some regard. For trade being dead, I'm weaving at a fall. But I hope in a few months, it will make mends for all.
Hello, and welcome to the Seventh Row Podcast, our flagship film podcast about films we love and how they make us feel. Seventh Row is an online film criticism publication dedicated to helping you revel in the afterglow of outstanding, under-the-radar cinema. Through in-depth interviews and well-researched essays, we demystify the myriad technical choices behind films we love. Every 2 months, we release an ebook bringing together thoughtful criticism about a film, filmmaker, or topic. Today's episode is the companion episode for our ebook on Mike Lee, called Peter Lewin Process, a Mike Lee Collaboration, which will be released on April 26. The book uncovers the mystery behind how Mike Lee makes films, as told by the man himself and the people he works with. We talk specifically with his collaborators on Peter Lewin, including actors Maxine Peake and Rory Kinnear. But all of the department heads have worked with Mike for years and provide insights on Lee's overall process and how this was done on other films. You can find out more about the book at mikeleebook.com. Today, we'll be discussing Lee's latest film, Peter Lewin, why it's great and how it fits into Mike Lee's oeuvre. We'll also talk about what we've learned while researching the book about how Peter Lewin was made and Mike Lee's process in general. Our guests today are Executive Editor Orla Smith.
Hi.
Associate Editor Brett Party.
Hello.
And I'm Alex Heaney, Editor-in-Chief of Seventh Row. So we're going to start by talking about what our first experiences were with Peter Lewin and what we worked on for the book. So I guess I was the first person at Seventh Row to see Peter Lewin. I saw it at the Toronto Film Festival in September, and I just completely fell in love with it. I was so impressed by the performances, and of course it doesn't hurt that it has two of my favorite Hamlets in it, Rory Kinnear and Maxine Peake. And I was just in awe at just how well blocked it is and designed. And I interviewed Mike Lee at TIFF and talked about his process, and he's just such a wonderful, engaging, thoughtful speaker that I basically sat there with hearts in my eyes the whole time and got really excited about exploring his process and films in more detail.
Mm-hmm. And then I heard you gushing about it at the same time as like everyone else was saying that it was really disappointing. And I was like, well, like me and Alex have been in the situation before with films like On Chesil Beach, where everyone hates them, and then we both love them. So I was like, okay, I'll trust her on this one. And I remember I saw it at the London Film Festival the month after you saw it. And I think the screening was like around the same time as another screening that was more popular for a film that was less good. And I decided to go to see Peter Lewin. No one else was there, and it was fantastic, and it kind of like 2.5 hours flew by, and I didn't understand like why no one else was raving about this film except for Alex, of course, and a few others. And yeah, like it's just a continuation, but people were talking about it as like a disappointment for Mike Lee, who's obviously had this long storied career, but it is like absolutely a continuation of his fascinating process that creates these very lived-in films. And yeah, like I was also hearing that Mike Lee interview, like fascinated to delve into that process a bit more. And I ended up for the book interviewing Mike Lee's editor, on this film at least, but also throughout most of his career, his editor, his production designer, and his cinematographer, and his makeup and hair designer.
And I guess I also interviewed Rory Kinnear and Maxine Peake and his costume designer pretty much since All or Nothing, Jacqueline Duran.
And I got to transcribe the interviews, which is all I did for the book, but it was fun. And so because I was transcribing them, I got to watch a screener of the film, so I knew what they were talking about as I transcribed it. And that was really exciting because I've seen pretty much every other recent Mike Lee film, but I hadn't got a chance to see this one, so it was always exciting to get that screener link.
Do you want to tell us what you thought?
I thought we were going to talk about the film in general.
Yeah, but Orla and I just talked about how much we loved it, and you're like, I watched it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think how I want to characterize Peterloo. I kind of find it more interesting than good, but I don't want to, like, say that up front.
I mean, go ahead. We can have a fun debate here. You represent a large portion of the audience of the film if you weren't as enthusiastic about it as us. So it's a valuable conversation to have, I think.
Well, I feel like I'm sort of in the middle of that because I like it more than, like, most people seem to like it, but I also like it less than you guys like it.
Okay. You can also say how much more you liked it after reading all the interviews.
It's definitely better reading all the interviews. Okay. So, I watched it twice. I watched it before I transcribed everything, and I thought it was, like, it was probably my least favorite Mike Leigh film I'd seen, which still doesn't mean it's bad. I quite enjoyed watching it, but it just felt like it felt less alive than his other films to me. But then after reading all the interviews and understanding all the work that went into it, watching it again, it really made sense to me why he did this film, and it's not actually a departure from his previous films that are so, like, warm and human, and that when you're looking for that in the film, it really comes through the second time.
Yeah, I mean, I do think one of the challenges with the film is that there is a lot going on and there are a lot of characters. And though they're all really rich, it's hard to follow who every person is and what everything is going on the first time you see it.
Yeah,
there's like 100 more characters than a normal Mike Leigh film.
Right, and a lot of them are like small characters. They show up a bunch of times, but if they show up and you haven't heard them speak yet, you won't recognize them. But then when you see it again, then you can understand all of the details going in. I mean, I didn't feel like that made my first experience watching it not good. I just found it richer afterwards. And I was like, oh, okay, I see this guy. He's going to give a speech later and he's sitting in the audience for this speech. And oh, okay, I understand the system of how this organizing is working.
So yeah, Peterloo is about the Peterloo Massacre. It was 200 years ago, I think last year was the anniversary of the massacre in Manchester.
It's this year in August.
Oh, it's this year. Cool. So where there was sort of a peaceful protest in St. Peter's Square in Manchester, which was made into sort of a violent massacre by the mounted police who were there. Yeah, it's sort of, the film climaxes with that scene, but before that it is sort of a film of, you know, people giving speeches, like political speeches, working class people giving speeches to people in like local town halls and pubs, and intercut with the magistrates and the upper class characters who are in sort of like very opulent buildings, and contrasted with these working class characters who I think we spend most of our time in the film with. And we sort of get to know a few people, like Max, a character played by Maxine Peake and her family. And it's this slow burn of this tapestry of all these people coming together in this big massacre at the end of the film.
Some of the context for it, including where the name Peterloo comes from, is that, so the film starts with the Battle of Waterloo, and we're watching this kid who's a bugle player, like, just amongst this big massacre, and he survives and he comes home. And the film sort of tells us the story of what's going on in Manchester after the war, that, you know, the price of bread is expensive, people are starving, there's not enough work, Manchester is completely disenfranchised, they don't have any representation in Parliament, and so there's some grassroots political organizing that's going on to try to get representation for Manchester. And at the same time, you've got, you know, petty crime is happening because people are starving, and the upper classes sort of see this as an opportunity to just say, oh, you know, the poor, they're worthless, and we should beat them and hang them for like petty crime, and refusing to understand, you know, the systemic issues that are at play here. And then much of the film is then getting us towards the organizing for this big political rally, which is basically about getting people excited about and working towards getting a vote for Manchester. And the upper classes are so kind of freaked out about the prospect of the lower classes having any kind of political say, that they look for any excuse to claim that they're going to be violent, and then they send in the yeomanry and just completely massacre people. And it happened in St. Peter's Square, and so there's a scene at the end where these journalists who are there for the day are saying it's Waterloo in St. Peter's Square, and so they call it Peterloo, and I guess that was what was printed at the time in the newspapers, and that's where the title comes from.
Because it's interesting, Brett, that you said that part of kind of the disappointment of it was that it was so different from his other films, in the sense that it feels, at least it can feel on first viewing, more less character based.
Yeah,
less of a character study.
His other films follow like 2 or 3 characters, maybe like maximum of 5, and you get to know all of them and all their different perspectives, and you can really empathize deeply with him. And in this movie, kind of just as soon as you're getting to know a character, that character disappears from the film for a substantial amount of time.
Because character has always been Mike Leigh's thing. Because obviously this book that we've written explores his process. And like for those who don't know, it's all about rehearsing with the characters, sometimes for like, with the actors, sometimes for like 6 months before actually shooting, to work out sort of the entire life of their character up until the point of the film. 6 months of like really working out every detail of who this person is, and then his films, he writes the scripts around what he discovers about these characters in that rehearsal. So it all comes from character. So it is slightly unexpected for him to do something that's got so many characters. It's such an ensemble. It's not about like honing in on one person necessarily. But I also think that because he does still go through that process, even for this, it gives like an ensemble film like this an impressive amount of detail. Even if we don't dwell on like every character for as long as we might in one of his other films, you can tell that there's like, this is like a whole world he's created, which is like very impressive on such a big scale as this.
Yeah, I definitely feel like if somebody else had made this movie, it would be completely flat. Yeah. Because even though characters, like, they only show up for a little bit, or they come and they go, they're all, like, you may not know their name the first time through, but you could, like, describe each of those characters and what they're like and what their role is. Like, you really get a sense of who all of these people are as individuals. And so even though you have scenes with, you know, 6 or 7 characters that, you know, are only in the film for 20% of the runtime, say, you really understand all of their relationships and who they are and what their position is and what they're like. And I mean, 2 of the characters that really stand out, I mean, to me, and again, this, I'm like somewhat biased because I love these actors, is Rory Kinnear, who plays Orator Hunt, who is basically going to be the main attraction speaker at Peterloo. And I think Rory Kinnear described him as like a narcissistic celebrity. He's this great speaker, who's a gentleman farmer, but feels for the lower class plight. And Rory Kinnear is just kind of hilarious and amazing.
Now, I loved Rory Kinnear's interview where he talks about reading Hunt's free volume autobiography.
Yeah.
And about how it's just this series of tales where everybody else ends up being wrong and he's the visionary hero of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, and it's kind of dry also.
Yes.
And then I think Maxine Peake ends up feeling like the heart of the film, and she's the last person that we see in the film because she's sort of the matriarch of the central family, who are the representation of the working class struggle and people who are starting to understand what the political situation is and making up their mind about what they want to do within it and how they feel about it. So I kind of feel like she's sort of the heart of the film. But yeah, then there are a ton of other characters. But I do feel like they're quite strong. I mean, even the magistrates, who are deliberately designed to seem similar and uniform, like the costume designer Jacqueline Durand was telling me that, you know, they wanted them all in black and they wanted them all to look kind of like an indistinguishable mass, even though they did do lots of details about individual characters, they wanted them to look very similar. But, you know, there's the scene where they're waiting for the rally to start, and the magistrates are all gathered, and one of them, who's actually played by Al Weaver, is sitting there polishing his binoculars. to watch the event, and it's like, it's kind of hilarious. They're all discussing how horrible the lower classes are, and he's just sitting there polishing his binoculars so he can watch what's going on. So there's a lot of like little wonderful character details throughout.
I like the one magistrate. We see him preparing his speech about how horrible the poor people are and what a threat they are to the country, and he's like changing words and he's smiling to himself about how he's glad that he's changed it from like our glorious land to our sweet land.
Right, he's giving this great oration, but there's literally no audience because he's writing a letter.
Yeah.
Which is sort of, you know, part of the film's message of the kind of echo chamber of the upper classes.
Yeah, whereas you have these other scenes of oration which kind of like feel like big, almost set pieces with throughout the film, where you'll have like a scene, say in a pub, with someone giving like a rallying speech to a group of people. And it's sort of in the film when I knew, when I kind of settled into it, I knew I was in good hands, because like in a film festival, you're constantly seeing films with people who really don't know what they're doing with the camera. And to watch a Mike Leigh film in that situation is such a relief, because the way that he shoots these scenes are, it's just incredibly assured, I think. Like, he doesn't think you to do too much. You know exactly where you are. I talked to the DP, Dick Pope, about how they shot these scenes. And he was like, it's just all about perspective. He puts the camera sort of like where someone in the crowd would be, and we just watch, and there's no need to do anything more than that. And we watch these people who are speaking, and we watch the people who are watching them. And we really, I felt completely like I was part of that crowd, watching these people give these really impassioned and engrossing speeches. You're just completely sucked into it.
Yeah, I think something that I thought a lot about when I was watching Peterloo the first time was Julius Caesar. So there was this production of Julius Caesar last year starring Ben Whishaw. And the way it was done was, because Julius Caesar is somewhat similar to Peterloo in the sense that it's also a story about a lot of like political speeches being given to a crowd. And as people are sort of jostling for power. And in this production of Julius Caesar, like the audience for the play became the audience for the political speeches. And so when I was watching the NT Live recording of this, you really feel like you're there in the crowd listening to Mark Antony give his speech or listening to Brutus give his speech. And I had that sort of same feeling with Peterloo, that you really felt like you were there at the rally and that, you know, these people were trying to change your mind. And I thought that was really effective. But I think one of the things that's very interesting about Peterloo, and this goes into sort of Mike Leigh's general approach, is that it's very democratizing, because it's, you know, he never treats the crowd as an amorphous mass. If anything, it's the upper classes that are an amorphous mass, but the lower classes, we see individuals in the audience thinking about what they're hearing and making up their mind, and not necessarily, you know, just going along with anything they're being told. They make objections, they think, they look, you know, not completely convinced. And then we get to see the Maxine Peake's family discussing what they'd heard and what they think about it and debating it. And so he's really portraying these lower classes, not as sort of this amorphous mass that we don't know anything about, but as like thinking, feeling individuals. I think that's really a really wonderful sort of democratizing point of view. And something that Mike Leigh had sort of told me is that that's sort of what he does in all of his films, is he likes to make stories about individuals. And I think a lot of his films have sort of social issues or social ideas within them, and he often gets grouped together with Ken Loach because they tell often kind of like left-wing-ish British stories. And I think what's really remarkable about Peterloo and about Mike Leigh's film generally is that he can have this sort of political message, but it never feels preachy or didactic, because it's all grounded in very real, realistic people.
Okay. And at the same time, if you liked Ken Loach films, you might find this film's politics are kind of underdeveloped, in that like a lot of the politics here focuses on like motivational speeches almost. So Ken Loach's politics are sort of like less top down than this film could be seen as, and more about how people need to make incremental changes to bring about a different society. Whereas this film has a lot of like speaking to people to inspire them to do that, rather than showing them how to do that through action.
Yeah, I think this film is very concerned with systemic issues, that, you know, the disenfranchisement of Manchester and how that means, you know, that they are not represented. The fact that they're not represented in Parliament means they're being sort of treated unfairly by the folks in London who are making decisions without taking them into account. And then it's trying to show the whole system of people are starving and that's causing petty crime. And then that's feeding into the upper classes believing that, you know, they're good for nothings, and the political organizing that's, I mean, very interestingly, it's not just one person, there's a whole bunch of leaders. And even though Orator Hunt is sort of the star attraction at Peterloo, he's just kind of a figurehead. He's not a political leader. He's just a good speaker, and he's not really part of the organizing for that. I mean, I think the other thing that we sort of have danced around is something about how there are a lot more characters in Peterloo than in most of Mike Leigh's films. And I think that there's a trend that we see going back to, you know, the 90s and the 80s, where he was making much more intimate stories, many of which started on television with the Play for a Day films. And his scope has been sort of increasing over the years. And Orla, you can maybe speak to this some more, but I mean, I know one of the things that Dick Pope said was that he used to hate moving the camera, and now they move the camera quite a lot. And something that we're seeing in this too is it's not just two or three characters, but there's a whole big scope of people, and I mean, the film has basically battle scenes that Dick Pope thought about shooting by, like, getting inspiration from The Seven Samurai, which is probably not a film that you would think of when you're thinking of Mike Leigh films.
I mean, I think that he's, like, very willing to adapt and develop. I asked Dick Pope, like, how the process has changed over the years, over the decades, and how their collaboration has changed. He said the process hasn't changed, but, like you said, the collaboration has, because Mike Leigh has sort of opened up to moving the camera more, to having screens on set. And I, like, you could have this picture of him as sort of this, like, older filmmaker who's set in his ways. You have a lot of filmmakers like that who refuse to, say, shoot digitally, which Mike Leigh isn't like that at all. Like, Dick Pope made a specific point of talking about how they, like, they're very open to new technology, so, like, they've shot the last two films digitally, and they probably will shoot the rest of their films that way. And so, like, in general, he isn't, like, regressive in his filmmaking style, and you can see that he's widening his scope, especially recently, with a film like Peterloo, which is, like, very different from what he's been doing before, which I think is quite exciting, because, like, he's considered one of the great filmmakers, and it's exciting that he's not set in his ways. He's willing to, like, try different things and expand the way he's making films.
I like how, even though he's willing to use new technology, he's still sort of hesitant to do it. Like, I want to talk about the sound design of the film.
Oh, okay, great.
Because Mike Leigh mentions that all of the sound for the final battle was picked up on set.
Yeah, they didn't use any ADR.
Which is amazing, because the sound detail is so layered. Like, you'd think that they did pick it up, that they did do a lot of ADR on it.
Well, especially because there's so much stuff going on. There's so many different characters. There's so many things. Like, how could they pick all of that up and get the dialogue?
This is where, like, if those sound Oscars actually meant anything, they should definitely win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite the feat.
Yeah. Sound editing and sound mixing. Very, very good.
And that scene where they talk, the editor, John Gregory, talked about that he doesn't have a lot to do with the sound, but that they did want to move the sound levels of the cotton machines up in one of the opening scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, really loud.
I know, it's so loud, it's so wonderful. You really get this feeling that working there would just be the worst. You'd get home every day and, like, your ears would ring and it'd be very unpleasant.
Yeah, and they cut right between the working inside the factory, and then they cut outside, and it's like you hear nothing. It's just completely quiet. I think that's something that's really interesting in the editing throughout the film, is there's a lot of contrasts, especially at the beginning, not just between lower class and upper class, but just sort of the difference in experience.
Yeah, even like how unpleasant the streets of the town are versus the landscape that is featured heavily in the early film when the soldier's walking home.
Right. Well, and also the you see there the folks in Parliament there, it's just this huge crowd of people, and then that's contrasted with the boy walking home from Waterloo in this sort of like romantic landscape all by himself. And so it's really portraying the lower class people as individuals, you know, across this sort of rugged landscape, compared with the upper class people who are, you know, stuffy and in a huge mask huddled together.
And giving the hero of the battle hundreds of thousands of dollars while making the soldiers find their own way home.
Yeah. And then in contrast that you don't really see a hero of the political organizing. There's, you know, there's groups of people who are all working together. There's, you know, seven or eight main leaders as opposed to just one person who's dictating everything and getting all the glory, which also means that when some of them are arrested, it doesn't stop the movement because they've still got other people who are running the show. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was how the Orla's interview with Christine Blundell has completely changed how I watch movies now, because I had no real understanding of what makeup designers do. And when I was rewatching Peterloo, because she's talking, and there's this really fascinating part where she's talking about like people's skin at the time. I mean, Orla, maybe you want to talk about it.
Same as you, I didn't even really like consider hair and makeup designers as key a part of the artistic process as all the other people we interview, like costume designers. And but no, her work is like so significant to, again, like to building these characters and like the research that she goes into, like the tiniest details, the way she thinks about how she's going to do the makeup is fascinating. So that we first thought of interviewing her because Mike Leigh brought her up in his interview, and he was talking about how he wanted he needs he, preferably his characters will wear no makeup, but realistically they need to be wearing some makeup so that they can be it can be accurate to the time. And Christine Blundell talked about how like at the time you have to think about how like people's diets were different, the way people lived was fundamentally different, and therefore that causes say skin problems that would be like most of the characters would live with because of their diet, because of the way they lived, which is so vastly different from how we live now. So she has to consider all those factors. She has to sort of like and she has to like do this incredibly naturalistic makeup that expresses the fact that like they have these dry skin problems, and like the level of like the period accuracy and the research that goes into something that you wouldn't even consider, like makeup design, it's just it's really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I was just rewatching the Richard II film from The Hollow Crown, and all I could do was stare at their skin and be like, "Your skin is too perfect for this time." I'm like, I see you and your perfect, like, moisturized, blemish-free skin, and your skin should be like red and ruddy and blotchy, and this isn't real, and your teeth are all white.
So basically, she's ruined, Christine Blundell has ruined period films for us forever. Because we can't watch any of them anymore without noticing how wrong they are.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, there's that other type of period film that makes everybody just impossibly dirty and have like really noticeably terrible teeth, whereas here it walks this like middle ground of just being subtle.
And they, I think both Christine Blundell, Susie Davies,
Yeah,
the
they both
production
talked
designer,
about they
and I
didn't want
think
poor people
Jeffrey
looking like
Tambor.
that.
Yeah, like like you said, they very much walked a middle ground between like obviously they would have bad skin because of how they lived at the time, but also they weren't gonna like it's very easy to say, okay, these characters are working class, so they're dirty and they look terrible and they have bad teeth and their homes are really like they're not kept at all. And they, I mean, they have far more respect for their characters than that, because like say Maxine Peake's character's house is well kept because she has pride for her home and they have pride for their appearance. They look after themselves as best as they can. They're not dirty. So they treat these characters with respect while also I mean, yeah, like you said, it's a middle ground, and it's really, really smartly done. It's really from people who have thought about every single aspect of how these characters live. So I first interviewed Susie Davies last year when we were covering On Chesil Beach, and I asked her about briefly about working with Mike Lee, and she brought up these things called actor surgeries. And in doing these interviews, we've sort of delved into what that is a bit more. It involves Susie Davies, the production designer, Jacqueline Duran, the costume designer, and Christine Blundell, the makeup and hair designer. So what they'll do is they will sit each key character down and they'll have like a hot seating session with them after they've done most of their rehearsal. So after they know exactly who these characters are, they'll sit them down and they'll ask them questions about their character while they're in character to sort of help them understand how they're going to work on each of their elements of the film. So costume designer will work out how that character would express themselves through clothing. The production designer will work out how they will express themselves through how they dress the spaces that they inhabit. And the same with the hair and makeup designer, how they express themselves visually. Susie Davies was fascinated that she said that the first question she'll ask is, if your character were to buy a kitchen table, where would they get it from? So some might say that they would steal it, some might say they'd get it from IKEA, obviously not in Peterloo, but in a modern film. Some would say that they'd make it themselves. And that is her starting point that really kind of gives her a strong idea of who this character is. And then they'll go off and they'll ask a bunch more questions, and that's where they'll sort of ground their work in.
And I think something I got out of talking to Maxine Peake especially was how helpful those actor surgeries were for her. And she's talking about, and this is something Mike Lee said also, is, you know, when you're working on another film, you kind of show up and they give you your costume and you might get some say, but otherwise you might be like, oh, I thought my character would dress like this, but I guess I dress like this now. And you might have some picture in your head of, you know, what your character's home looks like, and then you show up and you're like, oh, okay, well, that's not really what I thought, so I guess I have to adjust. But that doesn't happen on a Mike Lee film, because you actually get to work with the production designer to figure out what your home would look like, and you get to work with the costume designer to make sure that the costume reflects the character, so that all of those elements are not surprises and are, you know, consistent with all of the work that you've done. And so that makes it easier and to give a good performance on the day.
Yeah, I think that one of our main motivations in doing this book is there have been studies of Mike Lee's process before. So there's the book Mike Lee on Mike Lee, where he talks for pages and pages about his process, but there hasn't really been a study of his process, which is very famously unique, to that encompasses all his collaborators too. Because I mean, in general, people don't usually tend to think about production designers or costume designers. They see the director as this one big genius who has all the ideas, and everything comes from them. But what we were really interested in uncovering is not just his process from his perspective and what he does, but how each of these different people who work with him have to have their own very, very interesting way of dealing with his process, of fitting into that, of adding their skills to that. And it's really it's something that comes from a group of collaborators who are all working together in this very unique way that you don't often see in modern filmmaking. I think that's what makes what we were trying to do with this book unique, that it's not just about Mike Lee, it's about everyone in the Mike Lee family.
And I think that's especially important for understanding Mike Lee specifically, because, I mean, filmmaking is a collaborative process for everyone, but Mike Lee takes collaboration to a whole new level. He's got all the department heads collaborating with each other and collaborating with the actors. And I think that the importance of that and how that helps the performances and helps the world feel real is really underplayed and under-discussed. I think also that Mike Lee is often known as sort of an actor's director, and a lot of the narrative around him as a filmmaker is about, you know, how he gets all these amazing performances and he has such great actors. But then the technical side of things tends to get kind of ignored. And what was really interesting when you were talking to Dick Pope, is Dick Pope talking about, you know, how much Mike Lee enjoys the visual storytelling and loves making films. And so Dick Pope's tests before they actually start filming are so important, because they can completely alter Mike Lee's approach. Like, they didn't really know what they were going to do with Another Year, and he did tests for all of the seasons, and then Mike Lee was like, oh, that's what we're going to do. We're not going to pick one season. We're going to do all of the seasons. And so you really get a sense of how he thinks as a filmmaker, not just as a director of actors. And I think, I mean, I was reading a book of Mike Lee interviews that went from 1970 to, I think, the early 2000s, and basically every interview was the same. They were all like, oh yeah, he has this process where he rehearses for a long time and he interviews actors and he has actors do improvisations, and every interview talked about that, and none of them talked about any of these other aspects of it. And I think that part of how he gets these great performances and captures them so well is because everyone is collaborating with each other and with the actors and doing things in order to make sure that what the actors are able to have the best chance of giving the best performance. And that's not just because of the rehearsal, but because of all of the elements working together.
And not to take away from the tremendous talent of everyone that we've interviewed, but we talked about this process as being like amazingly unique, but I think actually listening to it, there's no reason it couldn't be replicable for other filmmaking.
Well, cost is the main thing.
Yeah, but even like, they're not operating on massive budgets.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is
it's
that
time.
Mike Lee has his clout. It's you wouldn't be able to get, not many other people would be able to get actors, especially of the reasonable stature of the actors he works with, to commit to 6 months of, like, out of their schedule of, like, very intensive rehearsal for one project. There's not many people who could get that. But yeah, I'd always, like, when I first heard about, like, how Mike Lee makes films, I'd always thought, people had said that it was sort of, like, a mystery, like, no one really knows what goes on in those rehearsal rooms, and the more I research it, the more I realize that's not the case at all. Like you said, I think it is, it's as a concept, it's not too hard to get your head around as a broad concept. It's just, we're really gonna, like, we're gonna rehearse a lot, like a play, and we're gonna understand who the characters are. It's just what filmmaking should be, just in a lot of detail.
The only real mystery in the rehearsal room is the same as any rehearsal room in the history of ever, which is, you know, actors share personal stories and personal details, and that's how they create these bonds with the other actors. And, you know, nobody's going to talk about those with the press, but nobody does that for theater. You can still understand what the actual process is like, even if you don't know, like, whatever story Maxine Peake told people so that, you know, they became closer in the rehearsal process.
Though, as we learned from our interviews, the collaborators are not always on the same page with each other. In the Mike Lee interview, he talks about he doesn't value storyboards. He doesn't think they're helpful to the process. And they may not be helpful to him, but as we learned from... I want to make sure I got this right. So the production designer wanted the storyboard. The editor wanted the storyboard. Did anyone else want the storyboard?
Costumes.
Yes.
I think Dick Pope talked about how it was a challenge. I think that he respected Mike Lee's decision. He quite liked it. Although, like, I think all of them talked about how it was sort of a challenge that they had to work around.
Yeah, I don't think necessarily anybody thought, oh, he needs to have a storyboard. But unprompted, everyone brought up storyboards. The only person I think that we actually prompted with a storyboard question was Dick Pope. Everybody else just brought up how difficult it was without a storyboard and without a script. So it's kind of funny, Mike Lee's story about how, you know, they kept wanting him to hire a storyboard artist, and he was like, well, I'm not going to do that, because if I did that, then the guy would just be sitting in his trailer, or worse, I would be breaking his legs. And then everyone else is like, you know, it would have been a lot easier if we had a storyboard artist. And the editor was like, I got all this footage of the battle scenes, and there was no storyboard, so then I had to figure out how to put it together.
But I didn't get the impression they'll be having a storyboard next time either.
No, definitely not.
I mean, he's a good collaborator. He listens to the people he's working with, and he's willing to adapt. But also, I think there are some things that he is, like, very, very firm on. and one of them being that he hates storyboard artists.
Yeah, and I mean, they all talked about too the challenges of not having a script. And Jacqueline Duran was like, "We didn't know who was getting injured on Peterloo, at Peterloo, so we had to make costumes, multiple costumes for everyone, including like ones for, you know, injuries and blood. But we had 100 characters, and we didn't know until the last minute who was going to be injured."
It is interesting reading how they all have to really step up their game to expand with the scope, like doing costumes for his film in the past versus doing costumes for like hundreds of characters. John Gregory talking about like editing together a battle scene, which is something he seemed very enthusiastic about getting to do once, but not something he ever wants to do again.
Yeah, and something that they all talked, or many of them talked about anyway too, is the difference between doing a period film and doing a contemporary film, and that one of the advantages of doing a contemporary film, this is something that certainly Susie Davies and Jacqueline Duran were talking about, is because you know everything about these characters, you know where they live, you know how much money they make, you know what they would do, that you're able to make really, really authentic choices about the costumes that they wear and what their apartments would look like, in a way that you can't really for something set in the past, because you just don't 100% know what it was like then, even with all of your research. And so you can't really have something which Jacqueline Duran talked about as being totally pure with period costumes or period designs.
But thankfully no one from 1819 is watching and is going to catch the small things.
Any other like concluding thoughts?
Well, I think what the interviews did really well is it helps you focus on what to pay attention to in a movie where so much is going on, and you can appreciate all these little things that the production designer, the costume designer, the makeup, editing has gone into bringing this to life. Yeah, I think you get the impression that it's not your typical recreation of history, just kind of like, well, this is what we had available to us, so we're going to recreate history the way other films have recreated history, but they kind of actually went and created a historical world that is separate from other depictions of history. That instead of going from like, well, this is what we have in the prop room and we're just going to use it and that will pass, sort of like I think a lot of times like happen with some adaptations. In this one, you've reading the interviews, you get all the work that goes into starting from scratch and building a whole world for the film to exist in.
And I think something I got from it too was just I learned a lot about the art of costume design and the art of makeup design and production design. I think the folks that Mike Lee works with are really, I mean, as you said, they are very talented, but they're also quite articulate about their work, which is probably in part because they probably have to be, because they don't have a script, so they have to explain to everybody else what they're doing and be able to talk about it. And so it's definitely changed how I think about all of these different crafts and what they do and how important they are for the film and how important that collaboration can be.
Well, yeah, what I really love about like this book is that we've made is that, yeah, it's a really like detailed look at Mike Lee's process, but I also think it's just like a really useful look at just how to make a film in general, because it's not that these people are doing their job necessarily in a different way than most people would be. It's just they're doing it perhaps like it's just that they're really good at their job and they're doing it in the most detailed way possible, and through that you get to really sort of like explore these different crafts. And like, if you're someone who is interested in just filmmaking as a process in general, it's just like to sit down with these people and to listen to or read their thoughts about the job they do is just endlessly fascinating, because we never really get to hear from people like that, like especially like a makeup and hair designer. We've never interviewed a makeup and hair designer before because we never thought to, because people don't think to talk to people like that, but there's so much to learn from them.
I think the only other thing we should talk about is like how great the Mike Lee and Dick Pope interviews are to listen to, yeah, as a promo for the pre-orders.
And I think, as you said, like these people have to be really articulate about the job that they do, because also they're collaborating with each other. They need to be able to communicate their ideas. And, you know, people like Mike Lee interview and Dick Pope interview were done actually in person. They're fascinating speakers too. Like, I found Dick Pope like incredibly charismatic and funny, and he like is you know, just like hilarious and charming to listen to. He's such a personality, and like we've included with pre-orders clips of the Mike Lee interview and the Dick Pope interview. If you pre-order, you will get access to clips of the audio from those interviews. You won't if you buy it after the pre-order period, but I would really like recommend getting access to those, because it does add so much to what they're saying to hear like the character in their voice as they like talk about like decades of work that they've done.
Mm-hmm. I think something one of our editors, Gilly, said when she was reading Mike Lee's interview is, she's saying, you know, this guy is just dripping with personality, or oozing personality. And I think that comes across on the page, but it comes across even clearer when you hear him talk, that this is somebody who's like very passionate, has a lot of ideas, and especially when he's dismissing why other films are not working well, it's really worth listening to how he talks about that. So, and you can, if you pre-order the book, you'll be able to hear that stuff. So I think that's the end of our discussion of Mike Lee and Peter Liu. For more information on the book or to pre-order it, you can visit mikeleebook.com. That's mikeleebook.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. If you like the podcast, we'd very much appreciate it if you'd rate and review it on whichever podcast app you listen to it on. It really helps new listeners find us. We'd also love to hear from you with your thoughts on Mike Lee and Peter Liu. You can tweet at us on Twitter at 7thRow. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/the7thRow. Follow us on Instagram at 7thRow and email us at contact@7th-row.com. And finally, visit our website at 7th-row.com. We'll be posting sneak peeks of the book on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and our website all through this week. So check it out. And the book will again be released on April 26th. You can pre-order it now at mikeleebook.com.